Typical but legitimate complaints about teenagers as they separate are that the boys withdraw and the girls claw their way free by fighting with their mothers. All this is normal. Digital extras that make separation harder for parents. The blessings and curses of technology change dramatically as children become teenagers. By the later preteen years, many are free to explore cyberspace on their own. This exposes them to social media, pornography, and dubious diversions, but it also opens infinite opportunities for creativity and learning. At a time when teenagers' schedules are packed with school and extracurriculars, the internet may be the only place they're free to roam without parental oversight. Fearful parents like having the teens safe in their bedrooms, where they can take only virtual risks as opposed to those in the real world. But this robs teens of the chance to get street smart, make mistakes, face consequences, and recalibrate their actions the next time. Self-control is what will protect your college freshman from the free-for-all of campus life. Parents may insist that virtual mistakes are educational enough, but the vast majority of such blunders, "She texted a pic of her boobs to her boyfriend," have fewer long-term repercussions than parents fear. Online adventures are no substitute for the experience a teenager gets by interacting in person with human beings, city streets, parks, weather, public transportation, and other features of the three-dimensional world. The cell phone is another obstacle to normal teen separation. The phones let parents track their teenagers' movements, spy on them, and stay enmeshed in their lives. And the stalking works both ways. A father of three complained that the Friend Finder app he made his daughters install backfired when they used it to monitor him. "They know if I'm at the store or work. They know if I'm on the way home. They hunt me down and text me and ask me for stuff. There's no escape." The college component. If parents have an all-access pass to their teenagers' lives via their cell phones, why aren't the kids rebelling, as is the time-honored tradition? They are, just not overtly. They're too frightened to openly revolt, having been raised on the myth that unless they get into a good college, they're doomed. A teen from North Carolina wasn't joking when he said, "My parents think it's either UNC, Chapel Hill, or Hobo." The road to college acceptance is too complex and fraught to handle on their own, the kids have been told. And in most cases, it's true. The college prep and application gauntlet soothes many of the parents' separation issues. Parent and teenager share a noble goal, to triumph over the teen's academic, social, and athletic challenges and gain entrance to a top-tier school. Parent and child pore over websites and applications, meet with tutors and experts, visit college campuses. The parent gets 4 to 6 years of close involvement, but the forced teamwork stalls or distorts the normal separation process for the teenager. Since separation from parents is the primary goal of adolescence, these modern-day obstacles to it must always be kept in mind when you're asking yourself, what's the best way to approach my teenager? What are we fighting about? What should we be talking about? Talking with Teens 101. Throughout the teenage years, your goal is not to be your child's friend. You're not going to be cool because they can't think you're cool while they're separating from you. In your role as cheerfully unhip authority figure, you can nourish conversations by maintaining an air of open-minded, enthusiastic but not gushing curiosity. Inviting your weary, wary teen into conversation lies not in being captivated, but, I'm going to make up a word here, being captivatable. Pretend your son is an exchange student from Kazakhstan, or your daughter is a visiting niece from a distant state. Learn about the fascinating customs of their faraway cultures. Listen to understand before you assume, judge, or try to fix. The crucial ingredient is restraint. Your calm tone, even cadence, and relaxed facial expression invite trust, which leads to candor and expressiveness. Learn to listen to your own voice. A raised pitch is much more common than shouting, and no matter how thoughtfully crafted your words, a tight-throated, tense, or irate delivery signals to the teen that you are lacking in conviction. This instantly opens the door to argument and defiance. Teenagers don't perceive their environment the same way adults do. Their brain circuitry is evolving. Studies showing functional brain imaging show that adolescents respond more intensely than either children or adults to emotionally loaded situations and images. They are particularly sensitive to facial expressions of anger and disgust. Their hormonal systems are changing, and this has been shown to impact their response to stress. For these reasons, your teenager may perceive a slightly irritated tone as yelling, mocking, or demanding. An eye roll or shrug can feel like disdain or anger. This has everything to do with the teen's developing brain and body and may not at all reflect what you intended. But the kids aren't always wrong. Teens are keen perceivers of emotional subtext. When your facial expression, posture, or tone doesn't match what you're saying, they trust the nonverbal expressions over the spoken words. The best way to keep the peace is to control your delivery. Channel the masters of reassuring nonverbal communication. Bartenders, hairdressers, the hotel concierge. This acting challenge may be hard to pull off when your baseline emotion is anxiety, but it's a necessary skill. If you want teenagers to talk with you candidly, you must play the safe and placid harbor in their raging life. The shift in how you communicate will begin as soon as your child enters puberty. Preteens are a combo pack. Unabashed narcissists who are also cruelly self-critical and embarrassed by their own existence. They keep up the facade of cool to cover their passion, shame, and humiliation. One sweet 13-year-old girl liked to hold hands with her mom when they walked down the street, but upon seeing any other teenager, even one she didn't know, she'd whisper, "Detach!" It was her mother's first lesson in that critical component of parent-teen communication. Don't take it personally. Keep in mind these basic principles. Acknowledge your teenager's anger, worry, or hurt without trying to fix it. Say, "That sounds tough," or "You were disappointed," or "What are you thinking of doing about it?" Not, "I'm calling that coach tonight." Be temporarily deaf to the siren call of your own technology. When talking with your teen, let your phone ring, a text beep. Recognize that both you and your child long to be rescued from conversations that are confusing or embarrassing. Keep your list of rules lean but firm. Consider your teenager's suggestions for alternatives. If they end the conversation in a snit or lash out and leave, do not follow. Allow them to have the last word, even if your dad would have grounded you for the same behavior. When you explode, it teaches your teen that frustration is intolerable. What do we want? Freedom. When do we want it? Now. The engine driving most conversations with teenagers is their yen for freedom and your countervailing instinct to protect them. Humor and a light touch will improve the ride. Regarding rules and obligations, a good-natured and consistent, yep, these are the rules, I know your friends don't have any. If you're consistent, they don't have to test you. This means not only keeping your word, but also being relentlessly predictable, even though they aren't, about things like dropping them off and picking them up on time. Don't try to win arguments with teenagers using logic, evidence, or persuasion. Even if they see your point, it's not worth the loss of power, so they must resist. That is totally unfair. You are ruining my life. None of my friends' parents fill in the blank. And don't overexplain. Teenage males have limited attention spans, and the girls will become irritated or use your explanations as fodder for an argument. Instead, speak in a matter-of-fact and candid way about how increasing freedom is based on increased evidence of accountability. Show us that you reliably return home on time this semester and we'll consider a later curfew during spring break. Let's try this. We'll check your grades a month from now. If the teachers don't mention lack of preparation or overdue or missing work, I'll stop nagging you about due dates and assignments. I won't even bring up homework unless you do, but I'll still be here if you want to talk over strategy. Deal? Because a lot of teenage pushback against rules is done to save face with peers, you can offer yourself as an excuse. Mom and I are fine with being the bad guys. Tell your friends, my mother would kill me if she smelled smoke on me, or my dad would ground me for 6 months. Feel free to suggest other justifications for responsible behavior as well. Even if teenagers don't appear to be listening, they are. If you made them wear a wire, you'd hear your words. For instance, they could tell their friends, I'm playing basketball this season, and that's why I'm not drinking. Sports practice is a handy reason to dodge any sketchy situation, as is rehearsal for group activities like theater, band, or debate team, or work commitments such as babysitting. With younger teens, you can role-play these conversations, and you can always offer to respond to a coded text message, for example, the letter Q, by texting, not emergency, but need you at home right away, we'll explain. A few traps to avoid. Certain parental moves tend to either rankle teenagers or backfire and cause more conflict. Avoid these whenever possible. Don't reprimand them in front of their friends. When you must communicate your displeasure immediately, for instance, if they have been unacceptably rude to you in front of others, tell them, you and I will talk about this later. If they continue to goad you, sternly say, end of discussion. Don't try to win back closeness by oversharing about your life or gossiping about your friends or theirs. Dealing with their own emotions and social life is hard enough. Don't compare them to their siblings at that age or to their polite friend. Resist saying things like, Ramona finds me in the house before she leaves to thank me for having her over. You don't even look up when I come through the door. Don't criticize their friends or crushes. What worked for dubious pals of your children when they were little is even more effective when they're teenagers. Keep your enemies close. Instead of pointing out the blazing red flags about your daughter's boyfriend, invite him to dinner. The payoff is watching her gain new perspective on her own, leaving you free to say, "Oh, really? Yeah, I see your point. He brags a lot." Don't provide goods or services and then grumble about it. Whether it's doing their laundry, late-night chauffeuring, or ordering takeout pizza, do it graciously or don't do it. Avoid being a martyr. Learn how to say no without feeling guilty about it. Don't promise to keep a secret from the other parent. If the teen says, "Mom, I'm going to tell you something. It's really big. You have to promise not to tell Dad," you can reply, "I'll never make that promise, but I hope you'll trust my discretion." Allegiance between parents, whether or not they're still a couple, is critical to teenagers' peace of mind. The teen will probably end up confiding in you on your terms. Don't say anything if they're 10 minutes past curfew. Teenagers have so few ways to assert their autonomy. If they're late by just a little bit, greet them with a friendly hi, sans irate undertone or raised eyebrows. The art of listening to teenagers. Listening to anyone requires the excruciating practice of staying quiet and paying attention when you really, really want to be talking. The hectic schedule of most families adds an extra hurdle to listening to teens. Whether you're waiting out a torrent of gossip or trying to extract a few informative sentences, it all takes time. So factor that into your approach. Then listen without defending yourself, correcting misperceptions, or apologizing. Listen to understand your child's perspective, not to decide whether it's accurate. Remember that listening does not imply agreement. You and your children are not equals in ambition, experience, or street smarts. You want to stay close. They want to start moving on. As you listen, regard teenagers' phoniness and manipulative power plays as clumsy stepping stones to separation. Curb any impulse to expose and humiliate them for their transparent excuses or shallow reflex apologies. It's easy to get defensive when they try to play you for a fool, but stay mum and let them have their say. "Mom, Dad, if I had known you guys would get upset, I never would have." As much as they may hope you're dumb, they know you're not. It's simply their job to try to get away with stuff, to lob and parry. Don't buy what they're selling, but don't retaliate with a character attack. Reinforce your reputation as a serious listener by offering evidence. Recall their friends or rivals by name and remark on specific situations they've told you about. "This reminds me of the time you and Sebastian walked the whole length of Golden Gate Park." If the conversation offers you a chance, mention beliefs they've shared with you, for example, about injustice or karma. Don't use these convictions as evidence of a teen's double standards or your superior intellect, but as proof that you listened before and considered what he or she had to say important enough to remember, and that you are once again listening attentively. You don't have to listen and respond in the same conversation. You can save your side for later. This is difficult because teens are insistent and their social lives are fluid. They want an answer now. By pausing the discussion, you may displease not only your own child, but possibly a horde of angry teenage zombies and their more lenient parents as well. No matter. If you need time to weigh the options, take it. You can bolster your confidence here by reminding yourself that you're being a great role model. When your child is being pressured by peers to hurry up and take it, do it, grab it, she may recall your delayed response and say, I need some time to think this over. Finally, as critical as listening is, it's not always appropriate. Sometimes you can just say no. Nobody's going to Lollapalooza. Not nobody, not no how. Old Yeller, that's you. I find myself talking parents off the ledge of shame and guilt far more often than I do teenagers. The cause? They yelled at their kid. Mostly, I say some version of, what else is new? You're the third parent to sit on that couch today with the same confession. Why do parents get mad at their teenagers for making them mad, and then hold a grudge, stop giving them the benefit of the doubt, and get even madder next time, and feel terrible about it but aren't able to stop? Parents lose their tempers with teenagers more frequently than with younger kids because they are scared for them and scared of them. When the thread of trust and connection feels so thin, it's hard to push yourself to stretch it further by confronting your teen about wrongdoing, cutting off his funds or freedom, or saying anything that will make him angry with you. Moms don't want to be that mom, the out-of-control screamer. Dads don't want to be that dad, the man who doesn't respect women or bullies a boy. But because you're a parent and not a child psychologist or crisis counselor, you will inevitably lose your cool. And to your horror, it may feel great. Being mad is much more invigorating than feeling sad, hopeless, or impotent. All that grief about your child growing up and you growing old is less painful when eclipsed by righteous anger. When this happens, try to apologize before the end of the day. Without defending yourself, you can say, I'm sorry I spoke that way. I said things I don't actually feel because I care so much and want to keep you safe, talk you out of your spiral of beating yourself up, or whatever the specific issue. I ended up saying things that, when I thought them over, are not accurate or fair. Losing your temper occasionally is no reason to recuse yourself from the task of setting your teenager straight. I tell parents, this is your job. Your kids are super smart and really dopey, and they do things that are devious and dangerous, and it's up to you to correct and guide them. No one in the family you grew up with was a master of diplomacy, so you're learning as you go. Maybe some people were raised with articulate, soft-spoken, fair, and forthright parents, but I've never met any. So calm or not, carry on. Texting, trap or treasure? Texting gives teenagers a safe way to say howdy, share feelings, ask embarrassing questions, or admit to mistakes. The distance can allow for more sincerity and playfulness than do face-to-face conversations. It also allows for breaking happy news. Mateo's family wants me to go to Utah with them again this summer. Who got picked to be county fair and rodeo ambassadors? Who's getting a $1,000 college scholarship? Me! Me and Kate! Yup, we did it, Mama! The best response to joyous texts. A short series of thumbs up or confetti or shooting star emojis, unadulterated by flat-footed where or when questions. Those can wait until there's time for a more expansive in-person conversation that includes both hugs and hollers and the gathering of essential details. But And I see this increasingly in the once sanctified space of my consultation room. To parents, every text represents a possible red alert. It must be glanced at just in case. Parents become like a cross between 911 operator and TaskRabbit. Only a fraction of teenagers' texts are genuine emergencies, but determining which fraction is a challenge because even with emojis, you can't hear your children's tone. You can't see their facial expressions. You can't tell if they're choking back sobs or offloading a concern so they can move on with their day. So unless they are Shakespearean in their texting content, it's out of context. The surest way for a young person to become a confident and articulate communicator is to talk, especially to adults. Texting a parent makes it too easy to avoid such interactions. One client's son, who was new to driving, found himself at a gas station and didn't know how to pop the cover of the gas tank. Instead of asking someone nearby for help, he texted his mom, who was in session with me. Naturally, she checked her phone and told the boy how to do it. The most productive and confident teenagers and adults I know turn off or ignore alerts when driving, in a meeting, or working on an assignment that requires concentration. If you consider your teenager's increasing independence a long-term project, I encourage you to experiment with waiting a few minutes or a half hour before responding to a worried or wondering text, even if you're free. This pause will give your teen a chance to recover from a spike in anxiety or the motivation to find needed assistance or information. And they have no problem waiting 15 minutes or forever to answer your texts. A tougher behavioral modification for most parents is to cut down on their own texting. I counsel parents to pause before texting their child and ask themselves, can this wait? What will be the effect on my child, on her independence, privacy, social, and academic life, to have mommy or daddy intrude on her? Yes, it's efficient. You just need a little piece of information and you know this is when she has lunch. But you don't know what she's doing at this moment. Is she flirting? Is she comforting a friend whose parents are getting divorced? Is she talking to a teacher? Is she together with her own thoughts, figuring something out, or enjoying a daydream into which you are about to insert yourself? Rather than offering parents a set of ironclad rules about texting, I suggest they view it in terms of family citizenship. When children send you a text, they may be interrupting you. When you text, you may be interrupting them. The family can talk together about situations that are appropriate for texting during the day. The basic criterion is this. Can this wait until we're together in person? If it absolutely can't, keep the message as brief and fact-based as possible. When do you need me to pick you up? The less emotion, the better. These guidelines don't apply to messages teens send to communicate things too heartfelt or difficult to say in person. In those cases, parents can respond quickly with sensitivity while still keeping their responses brief, in part because no digital communication is ever reliably private. The message can include appreciation that the child sent the message and a plan to continue the conversation in person. Thanks for telling me. Talk tonight? XOXO. This avoids the pattern I see so often, a frenzied back and forth, the teenager pleading or wheedling, the parent worn down and caving. One final note on texting. Don't get cornered. Texting is a great example of the principle of just because you can doesn't mean you should. Frantic texts lend themselves to impulsive responses rather than reflection about how the request, rebuke, or information download makes you feel. An investigation for facts that confirm or refute your hunches. Lost conversations. Side effects of the college quest. A 15-year-old girl told me, "Every conversation with my mom feels either like a celebrity interview or a police interrogation." Teenagers need physical and emotional space. They need unstructured, adult-free time to learn to navigate their colorful inner world and the outer world as well. Today's teenagers also need to learn how to articulate what's on their mind. From formal research and casual feedback from employers, it's become clear that this generation communicates much better via text or online than in person. Learning to speak with ease and confidence is a skill that will absolutely give your child an advantage later in life. But if all you're talking about is school, the conversations will be tense and abbreviated. The teen will withhold what really matters to her, closing off an opportunity to delve into complex thoughts and feelings with a willing grown-up. Among the families I see in session and meet during visits to public and private schools, certain patterns have emerged that are directly related to the parents' obsession with academic performance and college admissions. Test prep, test scores, which schools, how many, the relentless pursuit creates friction and hijacks opportunities for in-depth, heartfelt, mutually enjoyable dialogue. It dramatically degrades conversations between parents and their children. My teenage patients have reacted to the pressure by becoming little psychoanalysts, able to dissect their parents' every frown and sigh. But ask them about themselves, and they shift into polite job interview mode, formal and guarded. Like poker players avoiding the tell, they don't dare reveal their tentative passions or passing interests for fear their parents will smell resume fodder and pounce. "You should do something with that." I recall a 15-year-old boy whose mother dropped him off for a session. She was no longer in the building, much less in the room with us. Still, he leaned close to me when he whispered, "Guess what? I'm writing a play." Many teenagers get lost to themselves because their parents require so much emotional tending. Some, usually boys, go on strike, refusing to study or turn in assignments. It's what union organizers call malicious compliance. They show up but don't work. Others, ever watchful and captive to their parents' need for status and security, joylessly overwork and even overplay in competitive sports and or frenzied rounds of socializing until both their bodies and spirits are broken. I wish this were true only for the delicate outliers, but these are trends I see swiftly becoming the norm in my practice. Amid the rush to college acceptance, parents sacrifice the chance to observe their child evolving. They may think they know their son or daughter because they've brainstormed together about AP classes and community service points, but they underestimate their spirit guide. Beneath their parents' radar, teenagers are hosting backyard concerts, doing photo shoots, creating webisodes, making beer from hops they planted by the side of the house. They can learn anything online, So they're following their interests and developing sophisticated skills and communities. Parents who are secure enough can watch this parade without getting judgmental or over-involved, recognizing that self-expression is not a waste of time. Compassionate detachment is an excellent way to encourage teenagers' exploration of themselves. Parents try to fix too many mistakes before they happen. Let us enjoy failure so we can improve. Let me fail once, an articulate 12-year-old boy lamented. Another said, I'm just trying to warm up, to find out what I'm capable of. And a 14-year-old girl echoed the frustration of many others when she recounted this exchange. I said to my mom, I hated how my friends complain about getting B's. They think their life is over. And mom said, why don't you feel that way? Taming the topic of college. Families caught up in the college race don't see how it creates shame and fear in their children if they don't get into the right school, and resentment over all the time spent in test prep, which emphasizes tricks and memorization over intellectual depth. In the spirit of reducing unnecessary anguish and protecting students from having their high school years hijacked for the sake of their future, parents can take the lead in keeping the college campaign sane and realistic. Since your community of peers is likely infected with the virus, gain perspective by reading about the financial, spiritual, and moral price of an overheated credentialing race. Try Yale professor William Derezowitz's manifesto, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life, and Frank Bruni's Where You Go is Not Who You'll Be, an antidote to the college admissions mania. To prepare for conversations about college selection, open your eyes to the child before you. Reflect on the questions below, which deviate from the usual prep to meet your high school college counselor worksheet. What did your child like to do when he was 5 or 6 or 7? In which kinds of environments does he seem both relaxed and invigorated? Is your child pushing for a particular type of school to compete with or distinguish himself from a sibling? To please you? To displease you? Is there a field of study he's expressed interest in but not yet been exposed to? A part of the country or world he's drawn to? After you've had a few chats on these topics with yourself or your child, give him a book that will help him investigate his interests or appetites. It doesn't have to be about colleges. It could be a book about a particular state or city or field of study. There's so much college information online that a printed book can serve as a refreshing way to focus on just one enjoyable aspect of the search. It also signals your support of his individual passions over the pedigree of the schools. If he ends up with some eccentric choices on his wish list, let him pursue them if the financials add up, but require him to pay the application fee. When touring schools, always wait for your child's response before offering yours. Heed her gut reaction to the campus. My younger daughter had a Goldilocks experience. She described the students at one school we visited as too happy, at another as too sad. A half hour into our visit to her future alma mater, she said, Mom, this is home. Remind your teenager that every acceptance involves an element of luck or an inside game. For example, status, influence, or wealth of the parents. Statistics about transfer rates can mollify a teen's disappointment or worry. 1/3 of college students transfer to another school before graduating. Your child may or may not end up loving the college he attends, but if he doesn't like it, he can always switch to another school. For students, the process of deciding where to apply to college, waiting to hear, and being accepted or rejected is like dating naked and getting your heart broken in public. It's especially hard because so much seems to be riding on their decision, yet they're too young to really know themselves. Your adult perspective and level-headedness are their anchor in this hurricane. Last, but crucially important, make the dinner table a college-free zone. You already have a family rule not to use phones during meals. Make it include no talking about college and see how the conversations expand into more varied and interesting territory. This also limits the collateral apprehension younger siblings will experience as they gird themselves for their own college marathons. The missing link may be sleep. Next to college admissions madness, lack of sleep has the most unrecognized detrimental effect on the relationship between parents and teenagers. It's not uncommon for parents to mistake their teenager's sleep deprivation for a mood disorder, attention deficit disorder, or impaired memory. Panicky parents show up at my office when a teen's disposition or productivity tanks, or when every conversation devolves into a fight. One of the first things I ask them about is sleep. Teens need an average of 9 to 10 hours a night. Current studies of children and teenagers connect poor sleep habits with increases in anxiety, depression, impulsive behavior, and decreased academic performance. Getting by on just a few hours of shut-eye has become both a tactic for time management and a badge of honor among teenagers. Interviewing students about how much sleep they get, I was reminded of Navy SEALs or Army Rangers. One soberly stated, "I get 10 hours." But the rest reported, "I get 6. I get 4. I don't get any, ever." For adults, sleep prevents excessive weight gain by allowing the body to process carbohydrates efficiently, strengthens the immune and cardiovascular systems, and protects against depression and irritability. All good, all worthy. But for teenagers who are developing physically and laying down neural tracts that will last a lifetime, the benefits of sleep are more extreme. One example, during sleep, electrical signals in the hippocampus, the memory center of the brain, reverse their direction, going backward to edit unnecessary information from that day's input and reset the synapses so they can better absorb new information the following day. This is critical for teens who are still growing and are tasked with a heavy load of learning. Sleep also increases response time in athletic performance. It literally refreshes teenagers' minds, bodies, and spirits. Studies of adults show that when people who normally get 7 or 8 hours of sleep reduce it to 5 or 6, they eventually become convinced they have adapted to the loss. But University of Pennsylvania sleep researcher Philip Gehrman reports, If you look at how they actually do on tests of mental alertness and performance, they continue to go downhill. So there's a point in sleep deprivation when we lose touch with how impaired we are. One way to determine if teenagers aren't getting enough rest is by how often they get sick, because sleep-deprived people are more susceptible to illness. If your teen is sleeping little and frequently falling ill, have a discussion about which activities can be scaled back. They may resist because they don't recognize how impaired they've become. Through trial and error, find a way to make adjustments. Like adults, some teenagers are larks and some are owls, so take that into account when devising a sleep schedule with your child. Calming a troubled teen and knowing when the trouble is serious. The average teenager is regularly flooded with dark emotions. Shame, anger, hopelessness, helplessness. At these moments, you may be tempted to minimize her sense of doom and remind her of the joy she's felt in the past and is sure to feel again. This isn't helpful because her capacity to think is frozen. She's stuck in an unbearable present, and imagining a vague future happiness is too abstract. Jamie Lowe, in a piece for the New York Times called How to Talk to a Stranger in Despair, interviewed crisis negotiation specialist Sergeant Mary Dunnigan about her techniques for talking suicidal people off ledges. With some modifications, these strategies are surprisingly apt for talking teenagers through their emotional turmoil. The key is to keep the conversation going, even when your child is making scary threats, using distorted or illogical assumptions, or catastrophizing. Try these tactics. Listen attentively without interrupting. Don't criticize. Don't try to argue her out of her funk using common sense. Don't try to solve the problem right then and there. Repeat simple, comforting phrases such as, I'm listening. Ouch, that sounds rough. Say, let's take a minute because I want to make sure I understand. What I think you're saying is that your art history teacher plays favorites. Is there more to it? Gently and tentatively offer a longer view. His class will end at spring break, and you'll never have to take anything else with him. Is that right? Try to turn the teen's attention to a small problem or discomfort that can be attended to right away. Is she hungry? Feeling grimy? Would a hot shower help? You have to get them to feel the cold and get hungry so they're not thinking about their internal despair, says Dunnigan. Occasionally, but not as often as the more hysterical corners of the internet would suggest, a teenager falls into serious despair or depression. It's trickier to know when to worry about teenagers than it is about younger children, because teens are so secretive. Still, there are signs that will let you know it's time to seek the help of a professional. Are they hiding in their room more than usual? All teenagers escape to their rooms, but if you notice a drastic increase, you may want to pay closer attention to what's happening in the rest of their life. If they consume a lot of social media or games, are they mostly just observing? Research has shown that this behavior signals a higher risk of depression and anxiety because the teens are making social comparisons but not using the sites to connect. In order to figure out if this is the case, you'll need to discreetly ask about their online habits, since any sites or apps that matter to them will probably be blocked to you. Listen to what they say they've discovered online, who they've met, what they are doing. Does it sound like an active portal into a community that's exciting and matches their interests, or like passive consumption? This may not be obvious. For instance, one thing boys do that puzzles parents is watch videos of other people playing video games. That's passive, but it's also fun, and he's learning new gaming strategies. You can always ask in a genuinely curious tone, what is it you like about watching other people play? Are they participating in class? Some students are always more outspoken and engaged than others. To find out if your child's behavior has changed or if she seems to have mentally checked out, confer with one or more of her teachers. Have their grades dropped? Grades that are significantly lower than what is normal for your child may be a sign of emotional distress, but it may also mean that the student's workload is too heavy. Because parents are so focused on children taking the most advanced curriculum they can, it's common for the kids to be placed in classes for which they're not developmentally ready. They are overwhelmed, but ashamed and afraid because they've swallowed the Kool-Aid too. The stress, shame, and fear can result in depression. Have they withdrawn from friends? It's normal for middle and high schoolers to shift alliances, but pay attention to excessive isolation. How do they act around younger siblings or cousins and extended family members? Does your child's sweetness still come out, or has he or she gotten distant and hard? Are there signs they could be injuring themselves? This is more a problem among girls than boys. If they're cutting themselves, they'll wear long sleeves, pants, or long skirts when the weather calls for lighter attire. Are they losing weight or going on extreme diets? You'll see evidence of the weight loss, but the teen will deny the reason for it. It's common for teens with eating disorders to tell their parents, "I already ate." What do the grandparents say? If your child is close to his grandparents, ask them about this list. Maybe they've noticed, or your child has confided to them, something you've missed. To ascertain when your teenager could benefit from some sessions with a psychologist, look at his behavior in as many environments and get feedback from as many observers as you can without being overly intrusive in the child's world. If the different pieces of information form a troubling pattern, you'll want to make an appointment with a specialist who works with teenagers. You don't have to bring your son or daughter to the initial meeting. Just tell the therapist, "This is what we're seeing. Should we be worried? Do you want to meet with my child?" What teenagers wish their parents knew. When I give a lecture, I frequently spend part of the afternoon interviewing small groups of local middle or high school students about what they want their parents to know. At first, their good sense, generosity, humor, and insight startled me. Now I just expect and enjoy it. Before we dive into specific tactics for talking with teenage boys and girls, take a look at what students from around the country would say to their parents if they had the chance. What do your parents worry about that they don't need to? They think bad grades wipe out good. They don't understand that when you judge us, it just adds to judgment by classmates, teachers, college admissions people, and ourselves. They worry, but I'm already worried, or they ask if I'm worried when I've decided I'm just going to see how it goes. They expect me to be as smart as my brother. They ask too many questions. Who did you sit with at lunch? What did you eat? Tell me everything that happened between 8 and 3. They ask, who are you texting? What are you texting about? They think you have to save the entire country of Darfur to get into Yale. What's one piece of advice you would like to give your parents? If I ask you to check my spelling and maybe grammar, it doesn't mean I want you to rewrite the paper. There's a difference between pressure and motivation. My room is my temple. Don't act like there are only two positions at any moment, ahead or behind. Just because you were wild doesn't mean I'm going to murder someone or get someone pregnant. Please listen instead of thinking up the next thing you're going to say. Ask about my life, not just my grades. Say, how are you? Keep doing what you're doing, but calm down. Aversion at every school. Chill. What are the sweetest things your parents do that they may not realize you appreciate? When my favorite kind of ice cream just appears in the freezer. My dad watches The Walking Dead and Family Guy with me. Fiercely blushing sixth grade girl. This will sound lame, but I love it when Dad tucks me in an extra little bit if he comes home late, even though I'm already tucked in. When Mom talks to me about the world and not about college. She texts before a test, good luck, I love you, instead of texting after, how did you do? Mom gives me tiny surprises, like a ring shaped like a pancake that was pancake-scented. Dad says to Mom, let him. Chapter 7. The Exchange Student from Kazakhstan. Teenage Boys. Nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving too. B.B. King. His clumsy footprints trail through sitcoms, movies, blogs, and comic strips. He avoids speaking directly to adults, especially his parents, from the age of 13 until college orientation. The subject matter of any voluntary utterance is limited. Skateboard heel flips, his totally original Clash of Clans strategy, the catharsis and truth of hip-hop lyrics. Getting him to answer questions directly is nearly impossible. Decoding the messages hidden in his mumbled private jokes and slang is taxing, and the yield, likely just another excuse or refusal, the usual dissembling or transparent lie shouted from behind his closed door. The stereotype may make for great satire, but it's based on science, the neurobiology of normal child development. As a boy grows taller, his regard for his parents shrinks. How did the world's bestest dad morph into an irrational tyrant? The sweetest mom into a pesky nag? He doesn't know, but he does know where to find his sanctuary from their badgering. After a stop at the fridge, he's safe behind the closed door of his bedroom. Freedom from the public humiliation of a surprise erection. His beloved bed with the old worn Star Wars comforter. Headphones. Video game heaven, his guitar, privacy, decompression. Ah. Teenage boys' silence and secretive ways invite parents to fill in the blanks with their imagination. The new